for argument this morning is United States against Smith. Mr. Evans.
May it please the court. Charles Evans, on behalf of defendant appellant Glenn Smith, presenting the joint issues as well as Mr. Smith's individual argument. Your Honors, this was a close case that was pushed to a guilty verdict by improper opinion evidence.
Just as a detail, I'm puzzled by the joint brief and the four reply briefs. That seems very awkward. If the defendants couldn't, get together, they have disagreements, different levels of guilt and so on, then you could see separate main briefs. If they can get together and file a main brief, which they did, why not the single reply brief? Disorienting?
I can't speak for the other defendants. But again, the other defendants felt that they should file the separate reply briefs.
Yes, I know they filed a separate reply brief. I'm just wondering about the kind of planning or strategy that has one main brief and four reply briefs. Is this a breakdown of cooperation, or is this a new genre?
I think there was a feeling it would be easier for everyone to file their own reply briefs.
Okay.
But I mean, I understand that's not easier for the court.
Easier for you, less likely to be read.
Correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, the only issue in this case is whether the defendants had specific intent to defraud. And in rebuttal, the government argued that if all the witnesses knew receiver ISCS was a fraud, then the defendants must have two. Specifically, the government concluded its rebuttal by saying, and in the end, this comes down to really what LaTanya Thompson told you about that little voice of hers. We have four people here who didn't listen to their conscience. And the government didn't stop there. Right after
Is that objectionable? Are you objecting to the closing statement or what?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why? What was improper?
It's improper to use to argue that the beliefs, it's improper to argue that the defendants must have known the company was a fraud just because a couple of the witnesses had opined that they thought the company was a fraud. And this was an objection that the defendants made before trial in a motion that was overruled by the district court judge. But that wasn't the only part of the rebuttal argument where the government implied that the defendants had the requisite specific intent because the witnesses did. They also said, referring to two other witnesses, that those two other witnesses listened to the voice that said, this is wrong.
I don't see what's wrong with a witness saying, oh, it's a fraud, it was a scam. As long as the judge makes clear to the jury that a witness's use of terms like fraud and scam are not intended to be, legal descriptions. These are very common words in ordinary language as well as in the law. That's how people speak. And I don't think it's improper to use a word as a layperson just because that word happens to have a legal meaning as well.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'd like to say two things to that.
Someone bursts into your office, threatening violence and saying it's a scam, obviously that in itself wouldn't prove that it was a fraud, but, then you think, well, the person who heard this, and put it together with other evidence, he or she should have been thinking, keeping her eyes open.
And again, Your Honor, I guess, and actually more, think about it, three points, which is, one, the instruction given was a hearsay instruction. There was no instruction that...
But wait, there's also a witness that testified, at least one of the defendants said, I know this is a scam. But it's all right as long as I'm getting my share. I don't know if that was Price or...
I think that's correct, Your Honor. But again, I mean, the district court said that this was a close case with close evidence. And
district judges always say it's a close case.
In the introduction of the opinion evidence and the conclusion of the government's rebuttal argument, the last thought that they left in the minds of the jury was not that evidence. They had already gone through the non-opinion evidence, and then they concluded with the opinion evidence to argue that the defendants knew it was a fraud because the witnesses did. And back to Judge Posner's point, there was no instruction, and And it might be, I mean, on the point of whether or not scam is a legal conclusion in the vein of other cases that have held you can't use terms that are legal conclusions.
I don't understand how you can say a witness can't use a term.
Well, the government certainly uses...
A witness can't offer a legal opinion, but this is how people speak. These words, fraud and scam and ripoff and all this, that's how people talk.
The government certainly used the word in its rebuttal as being interchangeable with fraud and scheme to defraud, that the witnesses knew of this scam.
Of course, that's the government's theory, obviously.
And that's not our only point of error. The error is also that these witnesses were allowed to give their opinions that Receiver ISCS was a fraud, and then the government argued that the defendants also knew it was a fraud because of the witnesses did, even though these people did not share the same experiences. Just because people work at a company together doesn't mean that they all see the same facts and therefore would come to the same conclusion. So I mean, that's the heart of why the opinion evidence is not helpful. Your Honor, I see that I've gone into my rebuttal, and I'd like to save my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Evans. Ms. Kister.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of Joseph Rupert, and for the record, I filed my own opening brief and my own reply brief. I apologize for any overlap. In my estimation, the facts were so unique and so different with respect to Mr. Rupert that I wanted to highlight that by filing my own brief. But again, I apologize if that created extra work for the Court. The sole question, in my opinion, that's...
No, of course you're entitled to file a separate brief. It's just odd why there'd be separate reply briefs and one main brief. It's as if that after reading the main brief and signing it, the lawyers had decided, oh, wait a second, we don't really hang together. Just odd. Not important.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Because I filed my own separate opening brief, I thought it made more sense not to join in a reply brief. That might have complicated things all the more with respect to Mr. Rupert. I think he's in a unique position. I think he's distinct from the other defendants with respect to the evidence that was presented by the government. The real question is, and I think we can all concede that he was the pitch man here. He gave the sales pitch for the company. He was a guy that conducted the first phase orientation, put the best spin on the company, painted it in a rosy light. It was his job to make people want to come work there and to think that there was potential for them there. But the real question is, did he do that knowing he was setting them up, that the whole thing was a setup, that the company eventually would take their money and give them no jobs and never intended to give them any jobs? And from what we know of the record here, he had no way of knowing that. There's nothing from which to infer that he knew what happened to these people on down the line, other than the fact that he knew there were complaints. But he doesn't know anything particular with respect to those complaints. There's no evidence regarding the number of complaints that he was privy to. For all he knew, this was a new startup company. It was probably being poorly managed. It was going through growing pains. This young man had no corporate experience. This was his first foray into a corporate setting. He had been picked up working in a mall, in a hat store.
So why do you think the jury convicted him?
It's a good question, Your Honor. And my initial response is because he was tried along with everybody else. Against whom there was more evidence, different evidence. I don't know. I mean, you know, everybody who grappled with this case, from the district judge through the FBI agent, through the co-defendants, had problems with Mr. Rupert's lack of involvement. The judge at sentencing said, "This is one of the hardest things I've done in a long time in having to sentence this young man." LaShonda Mitchell evidently told the FBI agent that she believed that Joe Rupert thought this was a legitimate company, and that's in the probation report. as is the assessment of the FBI agent, Agent Broussakis, who says, I thought this guy was pretty honest. He came from a good family. It's in the probation report. I've read a lot of probation reports over the years, as I'm sure the court has.
No, that's not evidence. I know that, Your Honor.
But this is the place of last resort for this young man who is presently out on bond pending the decision of this court. And I would ask that, I see that my time has run out, that the evidence be judged very carefully, and I know that it will be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bradshaw.
May it please the Court, my name is Beth Bradshaw, and I represent Christopher Price. The question today is not whether the evidence at trial was sufficient to establish that Christopher Price could have or should have known that what was going on at receiver was a fraud, but whether he actually knew that there were no jobs available at receiver. We submit that the evidence was insufficient to establish that conclusion. Christopher Price, in contrast to the former employee witnesses who testified for the government at trial, had good reason to believe that receiver was a legitimate operation. He had
Wasn't Price the one who allegedly told one of the people who testified for the government that, I know this is a scam, but it's all right with me as long as I'm getting my share or something of that effect?
Judge, that was Christopher Price. Tony Vols testified at trial that Christopher had made a statement like that. But that is a far cry from the version of the story that Tony Vols told the government during his proffer sessions.
Yeah, but the jury heard those statements and evaluated which one they wanted to put more weight on.
They did, Judge, and they also heard the cross-examination of Mr. Vols, where it was made clear that just two years after the events at issue, in his proffer session, the story that Mr. Vols told the government was that what Chris had said was he asked Mr. Vols, are people getting jobs? And Mr. Vols assured him, yes, according to Frank Panis, people are getting jobs. There was a second proffer session where Price was discussed.
All of this just makes it sound like it's a jury question, and we don't. If there's conflicting testimony, it's the jury, not the Court of Appeals, that makes the decision.
I understand, Judge, that this court does not sit to reweigh evidence and reassess the credibility of witness testimony. But in extraordinary circumstances, this court can do that, and we submit that this is an extraordinary circumstance given what came out on cross-examination.
Anybody who worked there not have known that this was a scam. The operating instructions were to tell the marks that only 3% would be called back for interviews and then call everybody back. The operating instructions were to read their resumes and then make them an offer with a salary higher than the one they were expecting in just the job they hoped to get without any reason to believe that such jobs existed. Those are operating instructions to the people in the phone bank to systematically lie. I mean, isn't that quite enough to know that lies are being told?
Well, Judge, one point is that these tasks were separated and kept separate for a reason. To keep the first phase one interviewer and the phase two interviewer and the people responding to email separate, so there wasn't a lot of communication and an interviewer didn't know what would happen in the next phase. In addition, Chris Price is uniquely situated in that he went through this process himself. He went through a phase one interview. He went through a phase two interview. He paid $450. He completed the training. He got his money back, and then he got a job. So he had personally experienced what he was telling the applicants would happen to them, and he had reason to believe
he that wasn't aware of the 3% rule.
Judge, even assuming for purposes of argument that he was aware not only 3% of people got called back, that doesn't establish that he knew there weren't jobs available. This was his first office job, and I would suggest that could be considered a sales tactic. Part of recruiting is trying to convince recruits that this is a place they would like to come to work. and that would be a form of puffery and sales.
Well, that sounds like fraud, actually.
Fraud.
That is, you extract $450 by representing to someone that, you know, he's really extraordinary because he's in this 3%.
Judge, the red light is on, and I don't want to eat into my co-counsel's time.
Thank you.
Ms.
Bradshaw. Mr. Heslin.
May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Hessler. I represent LaShonda Mitchell. Ms. Mitchell is brought to receiver through a temp agency, given a cell phone and a script to read. She stays 3.5 months. She's paid $10 to $15 an hour. She hears plenty of complaints, but it is uncontested in the facts of trial that she's also told by her bosses that everything is fine and the complaints are coming from people who simply can't complete the training. There's no question that she participated in a fraud scheme.
Yeah, of course, she was heard to make this extraordinary statement about the company. It was identical to the company that had conducted another scamming.
If you look at that testimony closely, Ms. Patterson testified that Ms. Mitchell said something inculpatory about tell the people that it's the same company that was scamming people out in Rosemont. On cross-examination, Ms. Mitchell is asked the question, those are the words you used, I'm talking about transcript at 314, and her answer was, quote, this is the exact same company from Rosemont. Get him back on the phone and tell him yes. So when the witness is...
Right, so she's disagreeing with the recollection of the witness.
But that's the witness. The witness says that. When the witness is asked the question, were those the words?
I thought it said Mitchell.
Yeah.
It said Mitchell.
But it's not Mitchell disagreeing with it. It's Patterson clarifying what Patterson was saying. And so, even viewed in the light most favorable, if we view this in a light favorable to the defense, you'd say that Patterson was admitting that she lied. If we view it in a light favorable to the government, then she's simply clarifying what she said. And the clarified version is not an admission on the part of Ms. Mitchell's. Your Honor, you've asked a few people about the 3% claim. Again, when you look very closely at the evidence that came in concerning Ms. Mitchell, transcript 723, the agent was asked the following questions. Did you ask her about the 3% issue? And they're discussing the agent's interview of Ms. Mitchell in May of 2004. The agent gave the answer, yes, I did. What did she say about that? She said that she was not familiar with the 3% issue during her time at receiver because her knowledge was that 90% did receive a phone call.
After the lawyer said on cross-examination, said she told you to call this person back and say this is the company that was scamming people, Patterson says yes. The lawyer says those are the words she used. And Patterson says, she said that this is the exact same company from Rosemont. Get him back on the phone and tell him yes. Was there further examination along those lines? Did the lawyer ask her, well, what about that scamming people comment? Or was it dropped?
It was dropped, but that
it
is...
It was dropped. Well, you know, look, if it's dropped, then the jury is permitted to think that her first answer was the correct answer. If the lawyer had any confidence, the lawyer would say, look, you said a moment ago that you said this is, you told Mitchell that the caller said, is this the same company that's been scamming? But now you say, no, the exact words were, this is the same company. So which is it that you mean? And if she were very positive and said, no, he didn't say scamming, that would be very strong. But the lawyer, you know, left that dangling, which permits the jury to believe either of her answers.
I would suggest that it's a question of a specific answer versus a general answer, and that
that's
the specific would trump. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Deans.
It pleases the court. My name is Greg Dice, and I represent the United States in this appeal. Appellants ask this court to believe that their convictions resulted from improperly.
Can you raise your voice some, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellants ask this court to believe.
Do not touch the microphone.
I apologize.
Raise your voice.
Appellants ask this court to believe that their convictions resulted from improperly admitted lay opinion, testimony, and so-called hearsay inferences.
These are all the little fishes here. What happened to the people who were really starting this thing and these other folks?
As this court's aware, Tony Volz, who was the supervisor for these individuals, he testified at trial. He cooperated with the government. Yeah. In addition, Mr. Panisse was convicted in a related case, and this conduct here was considered relevant conduct in his sentencing. He was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment and subject to a $4.8 million restitution judgment. Mr. Gines is actually being sentenced as we speak. So it's certainly the case that no one here was
sentenced as we
Mr. Gines, Your Honor, J-I-N-E-S.
What happened to him?
What happened to Volz?
Volz was sentenced to 31 months imprisonment pursuant to the plea agreement.
So he got pretty much the same sentence that Smith and Rupert got?
A little bit more, Your Honor. Price received 27 months, Rupert 24 months, Smith 30 months, and Mitchell received 3 years probation.
But he was obviously more heavily involved in the shenanigans here than were any of these defendants, particularly Mitchell.
Certainly that's the case, Your Honor, but he also cooperated with the government.
Yes, but of course, you know, it's kind of unpleasant. So what happens is the big shot can turn in the little fry, and so he gets a big discount. And ends up being punished no more severely than the little people whom he turned in. So in a way, as you get promoted through the organization, you know, you accrue these plea bargaining benefits because you have more people you can turn in.
There's no evidence in the record as to whether the government first attempted to talk to these individuals.
We see this all the time, though. We see this all the time where the more senior people get sometimes significantly lighter punishment than the small fry, because they've turned in a bunch of small fry, makes the government statistics look good, and the small fry are usually easy to convict. They don't invest as much in their defense as someone who's a big shot and has, you know, resources.
It's certainly the case that in some instances the cooperator is higher up in the food chain. It's also the case that in other instances the person cooperating is lower down in the food chain and flipping up. So it happens both ways.
Just for an example, what kind of financial benefit did these defendants get for their participation in this scam?
The record indicates that defendants received $300 to $600 a week. That's what their salary was. They were paid in cash. And then they also received cash bonuses for the number of people they brought in.
It's not a lot of money.
It's
$300 a week is pretty close to minimum wage.
Well, I think for some of these individuals it may have been better than the alternative. And I don't think the...
You're not supposed to be paid lower than the minimum wage. So you mean these are
the alternative
these are
could be zero.
People,
the alternative being zero, Your Honor.
All these sentences, guideline sentences that were imposed.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor, but I can't tell this court definitively. But again, it was not lay opinions, it was not hearsay inferences that resulted in the convictions here. It was, as Judge Evans pointed out, it was admissions by each and every defendant. Defendant Smith, when interviewed by the FBI, Smith admitted that in July 2002, after having been at the company only 3 months, he began to doubt the legitimacy of the company due to the many inconsistencies in the literature and the growing number of complaints. That
Do
can be found.
These people have criminal records, defendants?
I don't think the record speaks to that, Your Honor. The record does not speak to that. That may be in the probation report, but that wouldn't be in the record. Defendant Smith further...
It's odd to waste prison space on such marginal people.
The defendant Smith further told the FBI that he stayed with the company after determining that it was not a legitimate company because he wanted an opportunity to work with one of Mr. Panisse's legitimate companies. The jury also heard testimony from LaTanya Thompson, who was a former receiver employee, that she approached Smith about all the complaints she had received, and Smith's response to her was that she shouldn't have a conscience because they were making good money. He thought that they were making good money. That can be found at transcript 137. Appellant Price, as Judge Evans pointed out, he told Tony Volz, "I know this is a scam, there are no jobs out there, but I don't care as long as I keep getting paid." That's the testimony that the jury heard came out of the mouth of Defendant Price. That can be found at transcript 374.
But I don't think you're sensing a lot of disagreement by the judges here on the strength of the convictions, but these sentences just, to me, seem pretty out of line for an advice. I know we have an advisory guideline range, and the judge has all kinds of discretion here, but what these people did just doesn't seem like it's so bad it justifies these kind of sentences. Not that, maybe there's nothing we could do about that, but I mean, this is troubling.
The sentences haven't been appealed, and while, again, the record doesn't I don't know that anything in the records, I certainly can't answer the question as to whether or not these fall within the guidelines. Certainly for a fraud conviction with a loss amount of upwards of $90,000, it's consistent with my experience that this probably was a sentence within the guideline range. So they were convicted, and the guidelines call for this sentence. So
each of the defendants is credited with the entire proceeds of the fraud?
That's certainly, if it was foreseeable to them, it certainly could be the case. Whether or not that's what happened at sentencing, I can't speak to that. Would the court like for me to address the hearsay and lay opinion arguments?
It doesn't sound like it.
Okay. thank you. The government would request that the convictions be affirmed in this case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Evans? You're the only one with rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honors. Mr. Smith did tell the FBI that he began to doubt the legitimacy of the company, but the FBI agent did not testify at trial that his doubts about the legitimacy dealt with the lack of jobs or fraud. Mr. Smith testified that the testimony was he doubted the legitimacy because of the obvious that, you know, there were no employee benefit plans or other payments. There was no Oster's instruction in this case. The defendants got over, and the government pushed the case over the doubt, turned Mr. Smith's doubt into knowledge by using the conclusions and the opinions of the witnesses. So there was evidence, and the witnesses testified to all the evidence that made them believe that the company was a fraud. But just because they concluded that doesn't mean that the defendants did too. In that testimony, in the argument that the witnesses believed it, was the strongest evidence that the government presented in its closing argument.
What would you have liked witnesses to say if they're not allowed to use words like fraud and scam? What do they substitute?
Well, the witnesses could have said we knew there were no jobs. But even if the witnesses use the terms like fraud and scam, that doesn't mean that that you can argue that the defendants knew because the witnesses knew when the factual basis for their conclusions hasn't been established. It's not a case like Giovanetti.
Well, if outsiders know there's a fraud, you'd think the insiders would know.
Well, but you still need a basis to show that the conclusion of the witness is based upon facts that the defendant had too. And we don't have that here.
I don't understand how the victims know that there's a fraud, but the perpetrators don't know. It seems odd.
Well, again, Your Honor, I mean, the witnesses were not customers. The witnesses were people who worked there and did similar but not the same things that the defendants did.
Okay, all right.
I see my time's up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. And Mr. Evans, Ms. Kister, Ms. Bradshaw, Mr. Hesler, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointments in this case. And the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.